generation, my generation, the second generation of the Holocaust survivors, I remember that our problem was that we couldn't complain about anything. I mean, our parents, our teachers, who obviously survived one of the most horrible experiences and traumas and were naturally not very stable, so they used to shout, they used to wave with the numbers on their arms and to shout all day long that they survived the Holocaust, and who are we, spoiled children with who born in a sunny country with the blue sea and piles of oranges. Oranges were an issue back then in the 70s. Who are we to complain about? In my house, anyway, in my everything was about the Holocaust. I mean, it was ridiculous. From time to time, when I went to school and got, say, 7 in math, so my mother would say, "For this, I survived the Holocaust." For 7 in math. But when I came back from war with, you know, 2 hands, 2 legs, 10 fingers, without any burning marks on my skin, so complaining that I feel bad was unacceptable. And be a man, overcome. We survived the Holocaust. And they also washed our heads. When I went to first grade, and my teacher wrote on the board, "It's good to die for your country." This was the first sentence that she wrote. It's an iconic mythological sentence that one of our war's heroes said before he died. This is the legend anyway. I remember a story that they told us about one of the school graduated soldier named Ilan, who threw himself on a grenade. Every Memorial Day ceremony, they told us his story, how he sacrificed himself to save 6 soldiers. And we were kids, you know, so here and there, before I fell asleep, I imagined that I am Ilan, this guy. I fantasized how I'm throwing myself on this grenade and died heroically. And every Memorial Day, my story is told, and the girls shed a tear. And there was also the playgrounds. I remember back then in the 70s, in the playgrounds, you used to have, you know, the slides, the swings, the slide, the carousel. And there was also a cannon, an old cannon from our Liberation War. We used to play, climb on it, play in it. And it was another facility in the playground, an integral part of the playground. And I remember that when I was 15 or 16 and I went abroad with my parents for the first time of my life to Europe, and suddenly I saw a playground without a cannon, and I couldn't understand why. I remember, I couldn't understand why there is a... So the traumatic society in which we lived in fucked us up completely. I mean, we couldn't complain, we had to repress, we have become an additional traumatic generation. Then came our war. I mean, every generation also has its war, which justified the trauma. So to answer your question, so perhaps the conclusion of the film is that fate cannot be changed, not because it's divine, but because of the traumatic Israeli men who shape the nature of the collective, a collective stuck in its trauma, and the little step that can maybe save us from the loop of this foxtrot must be done by the leadership, by a brave leader, I guess, but they usually do the opposite. They press on the buttons of the trauma with slogans that brings pathos to its peak from time to time. In Miri Regev's case, it's Foxtrot is destroying the country, for example. Like the film is a nuclear weapon that will, you know, erase us from the map. By the way, we had once a leader like that. Yitzhak Rabin, But he was murdered, and the dream was murdered with him. I remember a TV show a few days before he was murdered, and he described all his general peace plans. And I remember that the journalist told him, Mr. Rabin, you were aware to the fact that the majority of the people are not agree with you. And Yitzhak Rabin said, so the majority is wrong. And from time to time, we need a leader that will understand that the majority can be wrong. So there is hope. And also, you know, it's not. The trauma is not in the same at the same volume. It's a kind of fade out, but it's a long process. It's too long than necessary.